saving money right now at Menards. From smoke and carbon monoxide detectors to fire extinguishers and more, Kidde Home Safety Products keep your family protected in case of emergencies. Smoke and carbon monoxide detectors are perfect for your living spaces, offering protection and peace of mind. Save big money on all Kidde products at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Welcome to the Healthy Debate Show on UK Health Radio and podcast. I am your host, Andra Stanoyou, and today we have a truly inspiring episode lined up for you. Our guest is Grace Marshall, an award-winning author and the brilliant mind behind the thought-provoking book Struggle. In this powerful work, Grace takes us on an intimate journey through the trials and successes that define the human experience, offering a raw and honest look at what it means to navigate life struggles. In this episode, we'll explore the inspirations and motivations behind Struggle, discuss the profound themes it addresses, and learn more about Grace's own experiences that have shaped her writing. Whether you're a fan of Grace Marshall's work or a fellow writer or someone looking for a dose of inspiration and insight, this conversation promises to be both enlightening and uplifting. So grab your favorite beverage, get comfortable, and join us as we delve into the heart and soul of Struggle with Grace Marshall. Welcome back, Grace, to the Healthy Debate Show.
It's a pleasure to be back. Thank you so much for having me again, Andra.
Absolutely, Grace. So last time we met, we discussed about Productivity Ninja, isn't it?
That's right.
And I started implementing some of the things that you've proposed in the conversation. And I'm looking forward to understand more about Struggle and your book. So before we go into the topic and understand what's at the core of Struggle, the book you've recently wrote, tell me a bit about your professional work and, you know, the passion that you have for coaching others and being very close to those who struggle.
Absolutely. So, you know, my work, what I focus on is essentially how do we do our best work? So that's been the question that has shaped my work for the last 16 years that I've been in business. So I started off as a coach working with people one to one. A lot of my clients were people who were juggling business and family. And so too much to do, not enough time. How do we fit it all in was one of the number one challenges, which is why I ended up diving into the realms of productivity. But more recently, some of my coaching clients have been coming back to me and saying, well, I'm implementing the Productivity Ninja stuff. I've got some good systems up and running. I'm getting my inbox to zero. I feel like I've got my attention, you know, well honed, but I still feel like there are times when I'm struggling. Help. What's wrong? What's wrong? You know, what's going on there? And the more that I've had those conversations, the more that I realized actually struggle is the missing piece of the conversation. When we think about how we do our best work, it's not just about what systems or structures or habits do we put in place to help us to succeed. It's also how do we deal with things when life throws a curveball, when things are unexpected, when we hit struggle. And so that's what led me to write this book, really based on the conversations that I'd had with coaching clients, with colleagues, and you know, also with people when I go into companies and work with them in workshops as well. So from my own experience and my own observations, that's how the book came about.
So how much of the content in Struggle is drawn from your personal experiences, and how did they shape your perspective, you would say?
So I've always written from personal experience. That's the kind of almost like the only way I've learned how to write. So right the way from early days when I was blogging for my business, it was always through those personal stories and anecdotes that I found, there's the lesson, or there's the idea, or there's the connection. So in Struggle, as well as in my other books, you'll notice it's quite conversational. It's very down to earth and relatable. And what I find is that by sharing my personal experiences, it makes it something that people can really relate to. So it's what people have described as refreshingly human, because I think sometimes what we can do is sometimes we can look at things like productivity or resilience and see it in a very corporate way, and think of it in a very sort of conceptual way. Whereas if we can make it real and ground it in everyday experiences, we can then use it on a day-to-day basis. And if you read my book, you'll know that I don't have a big story of struggle. So I haven't, overcome some big, the sort of stories that you would get in motivational speakers where they've overcome some massive obstacle to achieve, scale a mountain or swim an ocean or something like that. What I tend to write about is more based on everyday struggle, which I think a lot of us can relate to.
Well, absolutely. And I think this is why the book is so easy to read. And even though it has 200 pages, you can go easily through them because the content is so relatable and easy to assimilate. Now, I know when we spoke previously, you said that you're not naturally the most organized person. But I am interested in understanding the research process, because even though the book is easy to read, I know how much work goes into making sure that the content is indeed relatable and it's easy to be understood and read. So tell me a bit about the research process and how difficult it was for you to put all this knowledge that you've accumulated for almost 20 years in 200 pages.
So writing this book, this is my third book. Writing this book was a very different process, actually, compared to my first two books. My first two books had a very strong structure, a table of contents, and it was really a process of filling in the blanks and filling in the gaps and following that process. And kind of you have the bones, which is the structure and the content, and then you fill in the flesh and the skin. Whereas with this book, I've often talked about how I wrote it as guts first. So it's almost like here's some of the observations, the essence. Let's put all that down on paper first, and then edit it and build the structure around it. So it was a very different process, definitely, in writing. And in terms of research, it was very much a case of, what is this thing I'm noticing here? Let's explore that and to kind of then write and curate the ideas around it. And there was definitely a lot of editing involved as well, because when you first start writing, as a lot of writers will tell you, you kind of have to start with that shitty first draft, to be able to just like get it all out, guts and all, and then go, right, what am I dealing with and how do I shape this into something that communicates the essence as well as the content of what I'm trying to say.
The book is separated in three parts, right? So I'm just curious to understand, are these almost like natural stages that you will go through when you're struggling, or they're not necessarily interconnected?
Great question. So when I was in the early stages of planning the book, there were two different structures I came up with. There was a structure that does take you through a process, and I realized that would be the structure of the talk, and that is still the structure of the talk that I give when I talk about struggle. But I realized that to take you through the process, you'd start off with the really hard bits first, and then it goes into, what can we get out of this place that we find ourselves in. And I thought, that would be quite a hard thing to read if all the hard stuff was at the beginning. So what I wanted to do was be able to shine glimmers of light to go, there is hope, there is good stuff that we can get out of this process. So the book structure needed to be different. And I ended up landing on, so the three parts are smarter, braver and stronger. And it's actually inspired by the Winnie the Pooh quote, which is that you are braver than you think, smarter. I'm going to misquote it now, but you're smarter than you think, you're braver than you feel, and you're stronger. So that idea that actually, sometimes when we think of struggle, we think this is the thing, this is my weakness or my failure, or this is a sign that everything's gone wrong, maybe something wrong with us. We see it as a deficiency, if you like. Whereas actually the whole book around struggle is, if we can learn to see struggle differently, we might actually discover that it is the place where we do our best work. It's where we can come up with those really smart ideas. It's the place where, if we can navigate it with courage, we come out braver and we come out stronger. And it's also the place where we grow as well. Rather than being a sign of weakness, struggle can be actually, the source of our growth, our learning, our discovery, and how we grow stronger, both individually, but also with you as a community, whether that's your work team or whether that's your family and your social community as well.
Grace, let's get even more specific, because I think there's so much really interesting content. And I really like the fact that you got inspiration from Winnie the Pooh, because this this shows in a way the book is written. It's quite entertaining from this perspective. And even though it talks about serious things, it does it in an easy way that's to some extent even funny, right? So let's discuss about the smarter part, the see the opportunity. What does that mean, to see the opportunity? We know very well that sometimes when we're struggling, we find it difficult to maybe see things as they are, because we're so emotionally involved into that particular matter that it's really hard for us to objectively look at ourselves and make decisions. So what does it mean, see the opportunity? What are some of the observations that you really think people should start considering when they're hitting maybe the rock bottom or a difficult time in their lives?
Absolutely. Yeah. So see the opportunity is, like you say, learning to see struggle differently. So how we normally see struggle is, like I said, it's a wrong turn. It's an obstacle. It's something to get over, or something to get away from, or something to get rid of. And one of the things I talk about in the book is we think of struggle as being inside a tunnel. We get tunnel vision. So we get fixated on finding the exit. So we either back up and go the way we came, going, this is the wrong turn, let's go back. Or we plow on through and we look for light at the end of the tunnel. We see that as a sign of hope. But both of those options are focused and fixated on, how do we get away from this or get rid of it? See the opportunity is about learning to look, almost shine a light in the middle of the tunnel. And because actually maybe there is work to be done here in the tunnel. And if we can shine a light in the middle of the tunnel, we can actually start to look and go, what is actually going on here? Rather than how do I get away from this, we can ask ourselves, what's going on? What am I noticing? So from an innovation perspective, often when, if you are a scientist in a lab and you're running an experiment, the moment something goes wrong or something unexpected happens, you tend to see that as, oh, that's interesting. Like that's, there's something going on now. And, and that's when we learn, we lean in and we pay attention. And that curiosity is a very different mindset to the fear curiosity that we normally have when we think, oh no, something's gone wrong. Quick, get away from it or get rid of it. So that see the opportunity is about activating curiosity in the face of fear when we hit struggle. Rather than think, how do I get away from this? We can start going, what is this? And start to actually pay attention and notice. And it might mean that, if you're not a scientist in the lab and you're doing your normal work and then something happens and you're like, oh, this was not part of the plan. Yes, it's disruptive. Yes, it might mean that you need to change your plan for the day, or even deadlines might have to shift. And there's going to be a part of you that goes, this is really inconvenient. And this was not part of the plan. It doesn't feel productive. But at the same time, if we can activate that curiosity and go, okay, what is actually going on here? What information does this give me that I wouldn't have if this hadn't have gone wrong? And often from that insight, we can then find that is often then the gateway to a lot of our innovations, our discoveries, maybe how we improve our process, or maybe we find out something new about either the situation or our customer or our work that we wouldn't have had if everything had been plain sailing. So when it comes to innovation, often those innovations come from disruptions. And one of the things I talk about in the book is how, you know, we think of the things that irritate us, you know, irritants. Where if you think of, again, taking an example from science, in chemistry, a catalyst is essentially an irritant. So if you apply that to the things that are irritating you in work or in life, rather than just thinking it's an irritation that, you know, I wish I didn't have, which can also be true, we can also think of it as, okay, if this is an irritant, if irritants are catalysts, what might this be a catalyst for? And then that might then lead you to some revelations, some interesting or useful ideas that you can take forward.
What do you think stops people from seeing the opportunity in general?
I think the big thing that stops us from seeing an opportunity is, well, there's two things. One is fear. And fear is the thing that's responsible for our fight and flight instinct. So it's that it was basically fear will frame struggle as a problem that you need to get rid of. And so that stops us from paying attention because we're trying to get away from it. We're trying to get rid of it. So what fear does is it limits our options. And it's a really useful survival instinct. So if you're being chased by a bear, you don't want to see all the options. You generally just want to see, what's my escape route? How do I make myself safe? Or what's the weak spot in my enemy? How do I defend myself? And that's exactly what that fight and flight instinct does for us. Whereas in work, that fight and flight instinct will also limit our vision. So that stops us from seeing possibilities or nuances or perspectives because it just tries to categorize everything into what's right, what's wrong, you know, who's for me, who's against me, who's my friend, who's my enemy. And that can often be what leads us to sort of that narrow thinking and narrow vision when it comes to work, but also it can lead us to, you know, polarized discussions, polarized society. When we have different, you know, opinions and different perspectives, and then we stop talking to each other because, you know, if there is a right or wrong, then, and we're on different sides, then that means that either I'm right and you're wrong, or you're right and I'm wrong. And, you know, it really does limit the options. So fear, I think, is the big thing. But the other thing that can often activate that fight and flight instinct is actually our relationship with time. So when we are rushing, when we're stressed, when we're rushing, when we're feeling short on time, our brain can also go into that fight and flight mode because that is a mode that kicks in very quickly. It puts us into action mode quickly. It goes, I can do quick. And, you know, and we can end up going into that fear mode without realizing because we're thinking, oh, I just need to come up with a quick solution or a quick fix. And often that can kick us into, I call it sometimes high functioning fear, because it doesn't look like I'm scared. It can look like I'm being really productive. It can look like I'm, you know, being high performing or strategic or diplomatic. But actually, if what's driving on the inside, if what's driving us is fear, then it's still limiting our vision and we're not always able to see all the perspectives or all the opportunities when we're in that narrow vision.
Once you were talking about fear, it made me think about crisis. And I know you approached crisis in your book. And I know you also shared in the book a personal experience, your midlife crisis. Tell us a bit about that and how that shaped your approach to this specific part of your chapter.
Yeah, so I call it my midlife crisis in my mid-20s, you know, get it over and done with early. But basically what had happened was I had been, you know, I'd been a straight A student at school. I had been very good at people pleasing and you know, basically figuring out what do other people want from me and then delivering that. And I ended up, after I graduated from university, I ended up in a small startup company in the marketing department where there was the marketing director who made all the decisions and then me who had to go and make everything happen. And I actually very quickly, when you're in that situation full of high achievers, lots of things going on, you very quickly discover what are your real strengths, the things that you actually do really well intuitively and, you know, that come from your core, I suppose, what your core strengths, and what are the things that you're just very good at trying to fit in. And, you know, a lot of what got me that job was around the fitting in. And so it was about me kind of going, right, it was like how I would approach an exam at school. What do they want to hear from me? Okay, I'll say that then. Which doesn't work when, you know, you're in a job where you need to use your own initiative. You need to be able to make your own decisions. Mind reading, it turns out, isn't something I'm very good at doing. And so, long story short, what I discovered was that, you know, yes, I can do this job, but actually it's not what gets the best out of me. And because it's not what gets the best out of me, they're not getting the best of me. So it's not the best job for me, but also I'm not the best person for the job. And so I ended up going through what I now affectionately call my midlife crisis in my mid-20s, and went kind of almost back to, what do I love? What do I get really passionate about? What are my core strengths rather than just stuff that I can do? So I'm very competent in a lot of things, but what are the things that are actually the strengths that strengthen me as well as the things that I'm good at doing? And that led me to quit my job. We also, you know, made some personal decisions at the time to start a family. And then after that, I ended up retraining as a coach and starting my own business as a coach, which is what's taken me on this whole journey of, you know, where my business is now as a keynote speaker, as a trainer, and as a coach. And I wouldn't have got that if I hadn't have been in that position where I was really forced to recognize my limitations in that job. So if I was in a big corporate, I imagine that I would have been good enough in that job that maybe I probably wouldn't have excelled, but maybe I would have kept the job, or maybe I would have just been moved sort of sideways to different departments and kind of tried different, you know, environments out. And yeah, I could have ended up stumbling into a role that suited me better, but that cutting environment was actually really, in hindsight, really helpful for me, because it forced me to really sort of go deep and rather than just go, well, I can do that, so I'll keep doing it. I'm sure other people have had similar experiences as well. Maybe sometimes when people have been made redundant, or, you know, had something, you know, some kind of a failure or a disappointment, it's cutting in the moment, but there's something that's really helpful when it comes to that decisive moment of crisis. You have to make a decision, and sometimes that will force you to make it a better decision for you, rather than when things are just kind of, you know, it's okay, we'll just keep doing the way we were doing before.
So I guess that made you feel quite uncomfortable that you had to get to a point where you absolutely had to make a decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's often, you know, the characteristic of struggle, isn't it? Struggle is that sort of unexpected discomfort, like I'm feeling uncomfortable. And what we can sometimes do is think that means that there's something wrong. And what I try and talk about in struggle is, what if we've got it all wrong about getting it wrong? What if that discomfort isn't a sign that there's something wrong with you? Maybe it does mean you're in the wrong place, and actually this is an opportunity, and that's where we see the opportunity. This is an opportunity to find what actually fits me better. At the same time, sometimes, you know, struggle can also mean, you know what, you're not in the wrong place. It's just hard. It doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just hard because it's new, or, you know, it's a hard thing. It's something, it's a stretch goal that you're trying to reach. And actually even just recognizing that discomfort doesn't mean you should stop. Like, maybe that discomfort in certain situations means, no, this is like, it's almost like when you're in the gym and you're building muscle. There's a discomfort to that, isn't there? But when we learn to kind of recognize, that feeling, that burn in my muscles is a signal that I'm growing and I'm getting stronger, then we can work with that struggle and we can go with it and we can use that. And that's what makes us stronger as well.
I love the analogy with the muscles. But when you said comfortable, I remembered another conversation when we discussed about productivity. And I believe you mentioned something that, like, if when we're, for example, choosing to respond to email, that's for most people something that's quite comfortable. It's kind of easy, an easy job. And we tend to do that when we're struggling to plan better, maybe our time or prioritize tasks. And as I was going through your book, I saw quite a controversial statement, Grace, and you need to clarify this for me, absolutely. So you put there, getting things wrong takes time. And that made me really, really think about and connect it with that comfortable element that I'm really trying to, you know, actually change my priorities and start with the uncomfortable and then finish with the comfortable. But what does it mean to getting things wrong takes time? What do you mean by that? And is it all right to get it wrong?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad you asked me about this. So, yeah, I mean, you know, given my background as a straight A student, you know, I'm used to getting things right and seeing that as like, this is doing my job and this is going well. But actually, if I look back at my career, if I look back at, you know, my professional and my personal life, actually, often it's the times when I get it wrong that I learn the most. And sometimes that learning is like, oh, realizing, okay, there's a lot I need to learn here. So, you know, the first time you ride a bike and you fall over, you're like, oh, okay, there's a lot I need to learn. But it's not just a corrective learning. There's also that sort of discoverative learning. That's, I've just made that word up. But that kind of exploratory learning, the kind of learning that leads to, it's not just about developing a known skill, but the kind of learning that leads to new knowledge and new ideas and new skills. So that innovative learning. And that innovative learning doesn't often happen without some kind of mistake or some kind of deviation or disruption from the norm. And so, you know, if you want to, even if you want to do the corrective learning, so if you want to get better at a skill, you need to be willing to do it badly first, and then to be able to, you know, figure out, okay, which is the bit that I need to get better at, and how do I practice that, and how do I get better at it? And to be able to do that learning, it does take time. Now, often what I see is when I'm working with teams in the workplace, I quite often see, yeah, there'll be a mix of seniority and a mix of experience. And you quite often get a couple of people who've probably been there forever, they know everything, they're really experienced, and they get bombarded with questions from other people, from the more junior members of the team. Now, asking questions is great. You know, I think that's a really useful thing to have within a team, that sharing of knowledge and being able to mentor each other and to be able to ask for help, I think is a really important thing to do. But what's often happens is, for these junior members of the team, they're asking the senior person because that's the quickest way to get something done. It's like, oh, I don't know about this. Hey, you, Andrew will know. I'll ask Andrew. And then you're there going, oh my goodness, how do I get my work done? Because I'm constantly being interrupted with questions from other people, and I want to be helpful, but at the same time, this is really distracting, really disruptive. And we talked about that, the cost of that distraction before. But then, you, if you say, if you're the person being asked, often if you turn around to the person, rather than giving them the answer, you go, what do you think? What have you worked out so far? Yeah, tell me what your thinking is. They might talk about, you know, the bit that they know, the bit they're not sure about, what they think it might be and how they might approach it. And in essence, you can coach them through working out their own answer. Now, that answer in itself is going to take time. So if you're really busy, you might just go, oh, I'll just give them the answer. And then, you know, I can carry on with my work. But that means they keep coming back to you for the answer. But for them as well, they know that if they can actually be coached through this, they can learn. And that means that they don't have to come back to you for an answer. Or even sometimes just for them to sit with it and go, right, I'm not sure about this, but let me try and work it out. Let me go through that uncomfortableness of getting it wrong, or, you know, is it this, is it that, that kind of discomfort of conscious incompetence, I suppose, when you don't know what you don't, you know, when you do know what you don't know, when you kind of realize where those limitations are and where you need to develop the skill. If you give yourself the time to develop that skill and to work it out, then what you get is the learning. But again, that takes time. So if you're up against a deadline and you've got a choice between, do I try and sit and work this out myself, or do I just get a quick answer from Andrea? If you're up against the deadline, you're more likely to just ask the question, but that means you don't learn. And so, you know, in terms of learning skills and developing knowledge, learning absolutely takes time. And you know, and it means learning takes getting it wrong. And that's where the getting it wrong takes time. But also when it comes to innovative learning, when we discover new stuff from something that's gone wrong, it takes time to pay attention to a mistake. Because when you make a mistake, I mean, it's already costed you some time, hasn't it? Because you've then got to fix the mistake and correct it and redo it. But then to also actually take the time to go, what happened there? Why did that go wrong? And what learning or insights might we take from this, this thing that's happened? That is going to take time as well. But if we do take time to do that, we might discover there's a process there that we can improve, that maybe actually that mistake happened because things were really clunky. Or there could be a personal learning. Do you know what? I was rushing. I was going too quick. I've packed everything in too tightly and I'm giving myself no margin, which is why I made that mistake. Or maybe we've made this thing too complicated, so no wonder we're making mistakes here. So we can find out why that mistake happened. And sometimes that can lead to a better process or even an innovation where we go, I didn't realize that about this thing. And so, then we can develop. So a lot of product innovations, the one I like to talk about is the post-it note. The post-it note came from one person having a really bad day because they were trying to create a super strong adhesive to hold planes together, airplanes. And what they discovered instead was a weak adhesive. Now, you could just chalk that down to, that's a mistake, that's not what I want, move on. But actually, what that person did was they took the time to go, well, this is interesting. I wonder if there's a different application for it. And eventually, that led to the glue that's used in post-it notes.
Well, that's a really good story of innovation, isn't it? And self-reflection, because indeed, self-reflection can be quite painful sometimes, but it's also the key for progress in general. And I think in organizations, people and leaders do tend to appreciate where self-reflection is present. So if you recognized that maybe you've made a mistake, or you actually say, well, I've made a mistake and this is where I went wrong and this is what I'm planning to do moving forward, I think that's far more appreciated than trying to maybe cover things or being very negative about the mistakes without making any efforts to kind of integrate the mistake in your day-to-day life. Because to be fair, this happens quite often, and it should, right? We should make mistakes in Absolutely. Order to produce better results. So Grace, I'm aware of the time, and we managed to discuss the first part of your book, Smarter, and see the opportunity, but I'm really interested in also touching a bit on the other two parts. So let's take a short commercial break, and then we will continue with part two, Braver, Trust the Process. So we'll be back with Grace in a couple of minutes.
The station that makes you feel good.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
And we're back with Grace Marshall. We're discussing her book, Struggle. In the first part of our conversation, we discussed about the opportunity and what it is to be smarter, get smarter. Now it's time to trust the process, which is so difficult, Grace, isn't it?
It is. Yeah.
It's so difficult. We briefly touched on fear before the break, but I think there's so much fear in to trust the process. So just tell us a few things about how can we be braver and trust the process? Because most of the times, this is not a tangible thing, right? We're not seeing it. We might be feeling it, but it's really difficult to just let it go. So how do we trust the process, Grace?
Yeah. And, you know, again, it comes back to how do we interpret the signal? So, you know, in Braver's Trust the Process, I talk about understanding that actually, you sometimes when we're struggling, it doesn't mean we're in the wrong place. So, for example, if you're feeling lost, you know, it can feel like, oh, maybe, you know, so like my midlife crisis, for example, you know, when you're in that place of transition, you when you're feeling lost, when you're feeling sort of maybe you've lost your mojo a little bit, or you've kind of lost your sense of energy, of purpose, or maybe, you know, the business that you started that excited you before is no longer exciting you, or the you know, career that you thought you wanted and you kind of got there and you're like, oh, I'm not sure this is actually, you know, reality is not matching up to my expectations. You know, those kind of feelings can be very, very uncomfortable. And we can often interpret those feelings as, oh, I've gone wrong. You know, I've taken a wrong turn somewhere. I shouldn't be feeling like this. And that can, you know, that can lead us to either just shut down and just go, I just need to work harder, or, you know, I just need to kind of chase that sense of, you may be chasing those dopamine hits of like, I've answered a load of emails, you know, ticked a load of things off my list, and sort of bury those feelings. Or it can lead us to feel like to lose our confidence and our sense of identity, to go, well, who am I if I'm not, you know, this person? But actually, those can also be moments where we discover more about ourselves. And those kind of pivotal transitional moments can be really rich in learning and discovery, but also in deciding, like, who maybe I have changed. Maybe my values and my priorities have changed. So who am I now? If I'm feeling lost, it's also an opportunity to then go, okay, this is, the process is about discovering. And so it is going to feel disorientating. It might not even be like a big sort of midlife crisis moment. It might just be, you know, do you know what? I'm navigating uncertainty right now. And that's something that resonates a lot with a lot of people in a lot of different ways. So, you know, at work, you know, a lot of companies, a lot of businesses are saying it just feels like we're constantly navigating change and uncertainty. And the words "I don't know" are words that we feel very uncomfortable with as professionals. You know, we think that actually knowing is about doing our jobs well, and our expertise, our leadership comes from what we know. So what happens when we don't know? We're going to feel like imposters. We're going to feel unqualified. And that can sometimes lead us to either discount ourselves or to, you know, the sort of other, obviously the fight energy, it would be to pretend that we know. And I'm sure that you or your listeners would be able to come up with their own examples of leaders that have pretended to know. And, you know, they've kind of gone, oh yeah, I know best and I have all the answers. And what that ends up doing is basically alienating them from the people that they're leading, because in their bid for certainty, they're shutting down any curiosity. They're shutting down being able to listen to other people. And so they're not able to build trust in that process. And so what I talk about in trusting the process is recognizing that these places that we find ourselves in, whether it's that place of wilderness where we're in the middle of transition, or when we're navigating new territory and we feel like everything is uncertain, to see that as a different signal, to kind of trust the process means this doesn't mean I'm in the wrong place. It means, you know, if I'm navigating a new thing, then actually feeling really uncertain and having lots of questions and not knowing the answers means I'm in the right place. I'm in that right place for learning. But when we're able to do that, you know, in conversations, for example, if we're having a conversation, so going back to, I mentioned polarized society earlier, if we're able to have a conversation where it's not just about who's right, who's wrong, where we can trust the process, where we can go, okay, let's trust that if we lean into that curiosity, we can maybe discover more about each other, that it doesn't have to boil down to who's right and who's wrong. Maybe we can understand more, we can develop more compassion, more understanding, and we can find our places of, a meeting place for connection rather than reasons for disconnecting. And then the final part of trust the process is about recognizing that sometimes we just have to go through it to discover. So it's not about having all the answers and then going through it. It's about learning as we go. So, I talk about the road we make by walking, which is around, it's great if you have a sat nav and it tells you where to turn right and where to turn left and you've got all that map already. But if you're navigating new territory, then you're making the map as you go along. And so part of the process is what you discover in the deviations, in the disruptions, and that helps you to create that map as you go along. And I think when you do that, you can actually learn to be present a lot more in what's going on rather than feel like you have to get rid of it. But also you learn to tune in and you get just so much more insight from that process for yourself as well.
I think a lot of the times too much planning does absolutely ruin the fun of the journey.
Exactly.
And and trusting the process, it's about, as you mentioned, adapting and planning as you go. You don't have to have all the answers all the time. And I think some conversations I had quite recently with leaders in a business, it was around the fact that there is the myth and expectation that leaders should have all the answers and leaders should have always a plan, where the reality is that you create the solutions together with your colleagues, with your employees. And I think the biggest thing that is missed quite often is how engaging and encouraging and empowering this is for someone that's sitting on the other side of the table. The fact that they get an opportunity to be part of the plan, not just have the plan assigned to them. So definitely, I think trusting the process is a difficult one, but it's an absolute must if you are planning to take control over your life, your decisions, and releasing some of that negative thoughts that are just making you feel like you have to tick some particular boxes, which, to be fair, most of the times they're just socially prescribed, isn't it? They're not necessarily things that normal people would necessarily put together. Yeah. So absolutely a very interesting topic, and I think it's quite offering, but we need to sum it up, isn't it? So let's prepare for the last part of the of our conversation today, where I really want to discuss the stronger, getting stronger and embrace the growth, because, I just mentioned empowering and I'm curious to see how you see things. So we'll be back with Grace Marshall and we will continue our conversation about her book, Struggle.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
And we're back with Grace. We're discussing her latest book, most recent book, Struggle. And we've done a wonderful job so far, Grace, going through the part one and part two. Not in a lot of as much detail as I wanted to, but I think it was enough to get people excited about picking up the book and having a go. So let's talk about stronger empowerment, embracing growth, because it feels like we're starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel. We're almost there, Grace. So take us until the end of the journey.
Absolutely. So, stronger is about recognizing that struggle isn't a sign of weakness. It's actually the source of how we grow and how we grow stronger. So lots of different ways that we grow stronger. The gym analogy that I talked about earlier, that kind of idea that actually it's only when we stretch ourselves and when we stretch those muscles that those muscles then develop and become stronger. And in many ways, yeah, we can think of that in our personal and our professional lives. We talked about comfort earlier. It's easy to stay within the comfort zone. It's also easy to stay within our competence zone. It's like, this is my zone of excellence. This is what I do really well. But actually, one of my friends that I quote in the book, Jenny Ainsworth, she says, there's not much stretch in the comfort zone and there's not much comfort in the stretch zone. And so if we do want to grow, whether that's our abilities, our professional development, our personal growth, then we need to be willing to go into that stretch zone and into that discomfort zone. And recognizing that when we're presented with that, that place, when we find ourselves in that place where it feels like, gosh, I'm struggling, it's not a sign that we're weak. It's a sign that we're developing. And if we can pay attention and stay in that place, then we can develop and we can become stronger. And in that section, I also talk about sometimes we develop unintended superpowers. So my husband, for example, he's dyslexic. And I don't know if you've ever had they're sort of puzzles where you look at something and when you read it really quickly, you skip past words. So when it's like, how many times does the word the appear in the sentence, and you skip past it and you don't manage, it catches you out. He never gets tricked by those kind of trick questions because he's dyslexic. So he reads every single word. He's like, oh yeah, I can count it there, and there. And actually, a more recent example that's not in the book, I got scammed recently by a Facebook ad for a clothing company. And what had happened was they'd kind of replicated the website. It looked very similar. I even checked the website name and it looked absolutely fine. But what they'd done was they'd added an extra S. Mm-hmm. And because I read really quickly, my eyes had just skimmed past that S. And I read it as like, that just looks like the normal website. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with it. Whereas I'm pretty sure my husband would have gone, that doesn't look right. There's an S there that it shouldn't be there because of his dyslexia. So sometimes what we perceive to be our weaknesses can also become our edge that strengthens us. And it gives us what I call unintended superpowers. And then when it comes to struggle strengthening us as well, it's not just about individual strengths. I think it's also about collective strengths. So in the book, I talk about how we have this myth of the single-handed hero. It's all about single-handed success. It's like, I made this happen. I did this. But actually, I just think sometimes what makes me weak individually might make us strong collectively, because maybe that's the time when I lean on somebody else or I ask for help. And often it's those points where somebody asks for help, whether that's a friend or a team member, when they're vulnerable and they're actually able to share a struggle, they're able to ask for help and you're able to help them, you're able to work with them on that. That in itself can be really powerful. That's where powerful teams, strong teams are built, is when we're able to be vulnerable to each other and to build that trust in each other. But it's also, I think, as a society, actually, our communities are richer when we're able to come together to work things out together rather than feel like we have to be that one person that solves things by ourselves. So I think there's something about how we collectively strengthen, whether that's as a company or a team or as a community, when we're able to embrace struggle and to talk about it openly with each other as well.
I think after COVID pandemic, the society has changed quite significantly, and we hear more organizations coming forward discussing about struggles, charities that are more obtaining more time on TV, giving more opportunity to speak out and speak up. So definitely things have changed for the past 3 to 4 years, and I think the vulnerability element is starting to to be normalized to some extent and make people feel more comfortable with who they are and their struggles. It's been really great, Grace, having you on today, discussing about your book, but also discussing about your personal struggles. You did say you didn't have that many, but I think you had the ones that are most common, and definitely that served the book in a way that you know made it be so successful. So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. I really want those who are interested in seeing more about the book, listening more about the book, because I don't know, do you have an audio version of the
book? I do.
Book, or?
Yes.
Brilliant. Yeah. So tell us, where can we find the book online?
Absolutely. So you can find the book in all, you know, your choice of bookseller, for sure. It is available on Audible as an audiobook. It is also available in Kindle and other ebook formats as well as in paperback. Wherever you like to buy your books, whether that's Amazon or bookshop.org, which is one of my favourites because it supports independent booksellers, do check out that book. So if you just search for Grace Marshall Struggle, you'll find it. And if you want to know a little bit more about me, or even if you just want to dive into, I've got the first chapter of the book that you can download as well on my website. So that's gracemarshall.com, and you'll be able to find out more about me and also dip into the book if you'd like more of a taster than what you've already had today.
Grace, best of luck with all your projects, and let's hope we'll speak very soon.
Thank you so much, Andrea.